Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum, a venue of spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. Richard Dawkins is a prolific author, scholar, and evolutionary biologist. His most recent book is Brief Candle in the Dark. It's a follow-up to his earlier memoir, An Appetite for Wonder. In it, he chronicles the second half of his life, from his Oxford days through his brilliant and controversial career. In this appearance, he reads from Brief Candle and riffs on his eventful life. He shares his views on a variety of subjects, including the lives of the dinosaurs, what Americans believe, his coinage of the term meme, and lunch with the Queen. Among other works, Richard Dawkins is the author of The Selfish Gene and The God Delusion. He spoke at Town Hall Seattle on October 7th, 2015. His talk was presented by University Bookstore and the Dawkins Foundation. UBS's Tim Nelson joined Dawkins on stage in conversation.
Hello, my name is Robin Blumner, and I'm the CEO of the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science. Thank you. So the foundation is located in Washington, D.C., and a lot of people ask, well, why is Richard, who's a native of the United Kingdom, founding an organization in Washington? And Richard's response is, well, it's because America is the place that needs the most help. So, if you'd like some more information about the foundation, the work we do, and how to become a member, we have a couple of volunteers in the lobby today at a table, and they'd be really happy to assist you. I mean, secular voices need to be louder in this country. Join us and help us to do that, okay? All right, now on to the main event. Richard Dawkins was the Charles Simony Professor of the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University until 2008. He is an internationally best-selling author of over a dozen books, including The Ancestor's Tale, The Selfish Gene, The Blind Watchmaker, The God Delusion, and The Magic of Reality. He is a fellow of the Royal Society and of the Royal Society of Literature. His Around the World speaking tour is the focus of a recent documentary called The Unbelievers. And how many of you saw him on Bill Maher? Well, October 13th, set your DVRs or whatever they're called these days, he's going to be on The Daily Show. Tonight we're here to listen to Richard talk about his new wonderful autobiography, Part 2, Brief Candle in the Dark. So please welcome Richard Dawkins.
Good evening. All right, are we ready? Richard and I agreed that the format we liked best was I'm going to ask some questions. Those questions will prompt readings of passages, and this will be the best way to really give you a good flavor of his new book. Brief Candle in the Dark, which by now you well know is available right there. So, all right, without further ado. I suppose a first question is, why did you follow up a fairly upbeat title for your autobiography of your early years, An Appetite for Wonder, with the somewhat more melancholy title, A Brief Candle in the Dark?
Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow. a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. But then the second half of the title, Candle in the Dark, that's Carl Sagan. And that is the... thank you. I'm sure Carl Sagan would be honored to get more applause than William Shakespeare. Science has a Candle in the Dark. It's the subtitle of his splendid book, The Demon-Haunted World. So it's both, obviously the reference to Brief Candle is a reference to the brevity of life, but the second half is the positive reference to science, the candle in the dark, the beacon that leads us all out of the darkness.
Thank you. So the passage I hoped you would read with that is the birthday dinner.
So this is the opening of Brief Candle in the Dark. What am I doing here in New College Hall, about to read my poem to 100 dinner guests? How did I get here? A subjective 25-year-old, objectively bewildered to find himself celebrating his 70th orbit of the sun. Looking around the long candle-lit table with its polished silver and sparkling wine glasses, reflecting flashes of wit and sparkling sentences, I indulge my mind in a series of quick-firing flashbacks. Back to childhood in colonial Africa, amid big lazy butterflies, the peppery taste of nasturtium leaves stolen from the lost Lilongwe garden, the taste of mango, more than sweet, spiced by a whiff of turpentine and sulfur, boarding school in the pine-scented Vumba Mountains of Zimbabwe, and then back home in England, beneath the heavenward spires of Salisbury and Oundle, undergraduate days, damsel dreaming among Oxford's punts and spires, and the dawning of an interest in science and the deep philosophical questions which only science can answer. Early forays into research and teaching at Oxford and Berkeley. The return to Oxford as an eager young lecturer, more research, mostly collaborating with my first wife, Marion, whom I can see at the table here in New College. And then my first book, The Selfish Gene. Those swift memories take me to the age of 35, halfway to today's landmark birthday. They milestone the years covered by my first book of memoirs, An Appetite for Wonder. Unlike An Appetite for Wonder, this second volume of my autobiography is not simply chronological, not even a single flashback from my 70th birthday. Rather, it is a series of flashbacks divided into themes punctuated by digression and anecdote. Since we're dispensing with rigid chronology, the order of themes is somewhat arbitrary.
Thank you. So you made reference to your childhood in Africa, which prompts this question. And I know this question really pertains to An Appetite for Wonder, but I wonder if you could briefly share with us the story of your early years, how you came to be raised in Africa, at what age your family returned to England.
My family, for a while back, had been sort of empire builders. This was when the British Empire still existed. And my father, after reading botany at Oxford, went out to what was then Nyasaland, it's now called Malawi, as a very young junior agricultural officer. The Second World War had just broken out, and he was called up to serve in the British Army, the King's African Rifles, which was based in Kenya. And so he went to Kenya. My mother had just joined him. They were newly married. She broke the law, by accompanying him to Kenya. All the other wives were told to stay behind or go back to England or go to South Africa. But my parents smuggled her into Kenya. And they drove in a sort of rattle-trap box-body car up through Africa. And so she was illegally in Kenya, where I was born. And maybe that makes me an illegal person altogether. empathize with President Obama here. anyway, when the time came to go back to Nyasaland, she wasn't allowed to go back because she wasn't there. She hadn't arrived, and so there was a lot of problem trying to persuade the Dundridges of the British administration that she really did exist and really was in Kenya and should be allowed to go back. I think it was my birth certificate that finally convinced them that she did exist. And then I was brought up in Nyasaland, now Malawi, until I was 8.
Thank you. Eventually came Oxford, and I am asking you to read this passage for no other reason than it's quite amusing. So, if you would, please.
This relates to my period of office as sub-warden of New College. Oxford is a collegiate university with about 30 or 40 different colleges, which are self-governing institutions. And they observe various rather quaint customs, of which one is formal dessert, a version of which is observed in most Oxbridge colleges, and which I never liked, takes place in a separate room after dinner, where port and claret, sauterne and hock, have to pass clockwise around the circle, and nuts, fruit, and chocolates are handed round by the most junior fellows. New College has a curious contraption called the Port Railway, dating, as you might expect, from the 19th century, which is supposed to, and occasionally does, convey bottles and decanters by a pulley system across the gap in the circle, which is the fireplace. Snuff also is traditionally handed round, but seldom actually taken, at least since the days of one venerable and long-retired fellow whose consequent prodigious sneezes would reverberate companionably around the oak panelling for the rest of the evening. Although the sub-warden doesn't have to seat people and their guests, as the presiding fellow does in some other colleges, he is expected to beam the role of genial host at dessert. I did my best, but there was one awkward evening. As I was helping people to find their seats, I became aware from a sort of ominous rumbling that all was not well. Sir Michael Dummett, immensely distinguished philosopher, Wickham Professor of Logic in succession to Freddie Eyre, stickler for grammar, conscientious and passionate campaigner against racism, world authority on card games and voting theory, was also famously choleric. When angered, he would go even more than usually white, which somehow seemed, though this may be my fevered imagination, to make his eyes glow a menacing red. Pretty terrifying, and it was my duty as sub-warden to try to sort out whatever the problem was. The rumble grew to a roar. "I've never been so insulted in my life. You have the most atrocious manners. You obviously must be an Etonian." I have to explain, an Etonian is an ex-schoolboy from Eton College, which is England's most expensive and most prestigious private school. The target of this damning sally was not me, thank goodness, but our quirkily brilliant classical historian, Robin Lane Fox. Robin was hopping with anxiety and bewildered apology. "But what have I done? What have I done?" I didn't immediately succeed in discovering what the problem was, but in my hostly role, I saw to it that the two of them were seated as far from each other as possible. I later learned the full story. It had begun at lunchtime that day. Lunch is an informal self-service meal, and fellows sit where they like, although it is conventional to fill up the tables in order. Robin noticed that a new fellow was hesitantly looking for a place. He courteously motioned her to sit, but unfortunately the chair he indicated was the very chair for which Sir Michael was heading himself. The perceived slight rankled, simmered up through the afternoon, and finally boiled over after dinner at dessert. The story had a happier ending, as Robin told me when I asked him recently. A couple of days after that distressing incident, he was approached by Professor Dummett, who offered the most gracious apology, saying that there was nobody in the college whom he would less wish to insult than Robin. Thank goodness I was never the target of his ire, although I might have been vulnerable, as he was a devout Roman Catholic with the zeal of the convert.
Thank you very much. Robin Lane Fox, you had a wonderful story in there about his horsemanship and... Oliver Stone.
He is indeed the world authority on Alexander the Great, and he was hired as a consultant by Oliver Stone to work on his film on Alexander the Great. And Robin agreed to do this on one condition, that he was allowed to lead the cavalry charge as an extra, which he did.
Yeah. Marvelous. In preparing for tonight, I thought that I would have a look at YouTube and see some of your previous interviews that I could find. And in a game that I suspect many of us play, I started entering your name one letter at a time, waiting to see how long it would be before your name popped up. So I didn't even get to the D in Richard before your name popped to the top. Now, Richard is not an uncommon name. Why do you think you're a YouTube star?
I can't answer that question. I didn't know I was. I mean, it's true that the Richard Dawkins Foundation does have a YouTube channel, and I'm told it has rather a lot of hits. I can't answer that question.
I suspect it's more than the foundation. So as you can probably see from this hall, we're in a building that once served as a church. Auspicious surroundings for this question. It's easy to dispense with the arguments of those who sit in pews and refuse to think beyond the notion that all you need to know about the universe was dictated by God into the Bible. But you must have debated exceptionally learned men and women who are convinced of religious truth. What were their arguments for the existence of God, and have you found them to be any more sophisticated or compelling than those of your average fundamentalist?
No. I have found some leading churchmen to be exceedingly charming, exceedingly intelligent. I have had discussions, I wouldn't call them debates, I've had discussions with the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, a man of exceptional intelligence and cultivation. Intelligence in the literal sense of the Latin word intellego, I understand, because he would finish one's sentences. And he would finish your sentences even before you'd hardly started them, and he finished sentences in such a way as to completely undermine his own argument. and a truly delightful man, too nice, really, to have an argument with, he sort of felt. Similarly, the British chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, somewhat similar character, and both of them immensely civilized, immensely intelligent. Perhaps the most interesting debate I've had with a leading churchman was with Father George Coyne, who was the director of the Vatican Observatory and an impeccable scientist. And he seemed to agree with everything I said. And so I finally, sort of more or less in despair, said, well, you seem to agree with everything I'm saying, so why are you a Roman Catholic? And he said, because I was brought up that way. It seemed that it was as simple as that. So no, I have never heard a convincing argument for the existence of anything supernatural. I'm not even clear what that would mean, what supernatural would even mean.
Thank you. A passage that I think would be delightful to hear on this occasion is...
Here's an example of the kind of thing in The God Delusion to which I suspect critics take exception as savage or strident, aggressive or offensive, but which I see as good-natured satire, a touch of the stiletto perhaps, but miles away from the bludgeon or from vulgar abuse. After pointing out that Roman Catholicism, though avowedly monotheistic, had leanings towards polytheism, with the Virgin Mary a goddess in all but name, and the saints attracting personal supplication as demigods, each in his own specialist field of expertise, I continued. Pope John Paul II created more saints than all his predecessors of the past several centuries put together, and he had a special affinity with the Virgin Mary. His polytheistic hankerings were dramatically demonstrated in 1981 when he suffered an assassination attempt in Rome and attributed his survival to intervention by Our Lady of Fatima. A maternal hand guided the bullet. One cannot help wondering why she didn't guide it to miss him altogether. Others might think the team of surgeons who operated on him for 6 hours deserved at least a share of the credit. But perhaps their hands too were maternally guided. The relevant point is that it wasn't just Our Lady who, in the Pope's opinion, guided the bullet, but specifically Our Lady of Fatima. Presumably Our Lady of Lourdes, Our Lady of Guadalupe, Our Lady of Medjugorje, Our Lady of Akita, Our Lady of Zaytun, Our Lady of Garabandal, and Our Lady of Knock were busy on other errands at the time.
Thank you very much. So you are married to Lala Ward, who, among many other talents, is an actress, and I suspect is known to many people here by role, if not by name. Have you found that when people find out that your wife was a cast member on Doctor Who, that tends to dominate the conversation?
Yes, I tend to sort of fade into the shadows at that point. Whether it was for that reason or not, I don't know, but I was invited to do a cameo on Doctor Who myself after Lala had finished her stint. And I didn't have much to do. I played myself as a sort of television pundit, and all I had to say was, "But we're in a completely different part of the universe. Look at the stars!" That was the sum total of my acting career.
Were you coached by your wife?
Sorry,
I say, were you coached by your wife?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. She coaches me in how to read aloud as well. I hope it shows.
So this is a section of the book.
This is the section where I describe how I first met her.
Yes.
This was 1992 when Douglas Adams reached his 40th birthday, and his party was memorable for a particular reason. It was there that he introduced me to the actress Lala Ward, whom he had known from the days when Doctor Who was at its wittiest, because he was the script editor, and she and Tom Baker gave added value to the wit by their inventively ironic playing of the two leading roles. At the birthday party, Lala was talking to Stephen Fry when Douglas led me over and introduced us. Douglas and Stephen are both absurdly much taller than Lala and me, so it was natural that we should find ourselves facing each other under a Gothic arch formed by Douglas and Stephen as they exchanged lofty witticisms high above us. Through the archway, I shyly offered to refill Lala's glass, and when I returned, we rapidly reached agreement that the party was too noisy for conversation. I suppose by any faint chance it wouldn't just possibly be a good thing to go out for a quick meal and, of course, return later. We discreetly slipped away and found an Afghan restaurant off the Marylebone Road. That Lala had read The Selfish Gene and watched my Christmas lectures was gratifying. That she had read The Extended Phenotype and Darwin as well was too good to be borne. I subsequently discovered that in addition to Doctor Who's companion, she had played a beautiful Ophelia to Derek Jacobi's Hamlet in the BBC TV production, and was also a talented and versatile artist, published author, and book illustrator. As I said, too good to be born. We didn't return to the party. I mentioned to Lala that I was about to embark on my American journey, having added to the itinerary a visit to John Brockman. She said she was about to set off for a holiday in Barbados with a girlfriend from the theatrical world. Impulsively, she asked if I would take her to America with me, although it would mean letting down her friend in Barbados. Equally impulsively, I agreed. Slight embarrassment then opened up. I was due to stay with Dan and Susan Dennett on first arriving in Boston, and later with the Brockmans in Connecticut. In both cases, one house guest was expected, not two. How could I broach the subject? Lala and I fretted that our host would ask, it is after all a perfectly normal question to ask of a couple, how long have you two known each other? And we would have had to answer, a week. As it turned out, they didn't ask, and it was only years later that Lala confessed to Dan the truth. Really, said Dan, with possibly mock innocence, I thought you'd known each other for years.
Thank you. Well, I suspect there's some scientists in the audience, so let's have a science question. You quote Stephen Gould in Brief Candle in the Dark as having earlier taken issue with your idea that genes are the primary units of natural selection. Specifically, you quote Gould saying, English biologist Richard Dawkins has recently raised my hackles with his claim that genes themselves are units of selection and individuals merely their temporary receptacles. Can you calm our hackles and explain to the laymen and women among us why Gould should relax?
Right. This is a semantic matter. There are two ways of looking at this. You can say, if you wish, that the individual organism is the unit of natural selection. But then, if you're asked the question, what is the individual organism maximizing? The answer is not individual survival, clearly, nor is it simply even reproduction, although that goes a long way towards expressing what the individual must be maximizing. It's more complicated than that, because in cases like social insects, where sterile workers don't reproduce, but do assist the reproduction of their fertile siblings, what they're really doing is maximizing the survival of their genes. So if you wish to say the individual organism is the unit of natural selection, then you have to say what the individual organism is striving to maximize is the survival of its genes. Well, I turned that on its head and said, look at it from the point of view of the gene and ask yourself, what would the gene be maximizing if it was the unit of natural selection? And the answer then is quite simply, its own survival. So it's a very, very simple statement that if the gene is a unit of natural selection, if we're going to personify anything as a unit of natural selection, if you personify the lion or the elephant or the zebrafish or whatever it is as the unit of natural selection, then you have to regard the personified individual as maximizing something really quite complicated. It's a complicated calculation of which amounts to maximizing its gene survival. But if you personify the gene, then the calculation is exceedingly simple. It's simply maximizing its own survival. Now, clearly, genes cannot really be personified in the sense that they don't work anything out. Genes are just DNA. DNA doesn't have intentions. It doesn't have conscious purposes. Maybe lions and elephants do, but mushrooms don't. And the individual as the unit of selection would have to include mushrooms and bacteria and everything else like that. It's best not to personify anything if you're fooled into thinking that it really is a conscious entity that's doing something deliberately. But if you understand that you're only doing that as a shorthand to get the right answer in your calculation, then you will get the right answer if you personify the gene. If you regard the gene as an agent which is trying to maximize its own survival, you'll get the right answer. And you'll get the right answer if you personify the individual organism, but only if you realize that it's maximizing a really rather complicated weighted sum which amounts to its own gene survival.
Thank you. I'm proud to say that the survival of my genes is in the audience tonight. is there a basic science concept that you have been surprised to find lacking in the majority of the people that you have met? What is it, and can you give us the Cliff Notes version of it, which I believe the British equivalent is York Notes?
Something that is lacking in...
A science concept that you've been surprised to find lacking among people.
Well, I mean, my own field is evolutionary biology, and that is lacking in some 43% of the American people, according to Pew opinion polls, which is a rather disturbing fact. It's even worse than that. I mean, they seem to think that the world is less than 10,000 years old, and that is not a small error. I mean, the correct age of the Earth is some 4.5 billion years, which means that if you believe that it's only 10,000 years or less, it's approximately the same as believing that the distance from, say, Washington to Seattle is 8 yards. So I guess that must be my answer.
That's a good one. So that leads us to page 144 of your book. If you would read for us.
Oh, this is about Gould. Oh, all right, I suppose. Yes, okay. My second story about the blind watchmaker I tell for no better reason than that it's quite funny. First, a little background. Many evolution skeptics have been puzzled by an aspect of the perfection of animal camouflage. They reluctantly accept that bird eyes are sharp enough to put the finishing touches to a resemblance of intricate perfection, such as that of a stick insect to a stick, complete with buds and leaf scars. Or another example, there are caterpillars that resemble a bird dropping. But then the skeptic says, how can you accept selection for the final detailed perfection of mimicry of a stick or a bird dropping on the one hand, while also believing that the same kind of selection shaped the ancestors of those insects on their first tentative fumbling steps toward a resemblance? I quoted Stephen Jay Gould on the bird dropping mimic. Can there be any edge in looking 5% like a turd? I answered the question in a way slightly different from Gould's. The very same eyes are presented with prey under a great variety of seeing conditions: dim versus bright light, corner of the eye versus full frontal, far away versus close up. A minuscule resemblance to a bird dropping might be enough to save a caterpillar's life when seen from a distance or in twilight. But a strong resemblance would be necessary to save its life when seen close up and in strong daylight. And there is the continuous gradient from poor seeing conditions to good, which provides a smooth selection pressure for every degree of improvement in mimicry from crude to perfect. The same gradient argument works for all complex adaptations, eyes, wings, all the chestnuts of creationist literature, and is of immense importance for the whole theory of evolution. That's the background to the story. Now, Stephen Gould's name appears several times in The Blind Watchmaker, and therefore also in the index. The index to a book, with its military-style backwards formatting, is a fine place to conceal a joke. It will not be noticed by many, but those who see it will share with the compiler a smile of secret complicity. I put in a little joke for Steve Gould's benefit in the index of The Blind Watchmaker. It duly appeared in the original British edition. However, when the American publishers saw it, they were aghast. They thought it in terrible taste, and they may just possibly, although I was too discreet to ask, have been conscious that Stephen Gould was one of their most bankable authors. Publication of the US edition was held up while the joke was expunged. Then, unintentionally, as a result of a simple oversight, the microfilm version containing the censored index was the one used in subsequent printings of Longman's British edition and Penguin's paperback. Michael Rogers, that was the British publisher, had intended that the joke should remain in the British edition. The fact that it didn't may, for all I know, confer on the first British printing a collector's value, along the lines of the unperforated stamps prized by some philatelists. Here are the two versions of the index entry under dispute. Spot the difference. Gould, S.J., 5% I, 81. 5% resemblance to turd. Well, I think, okay, that's it.
So to move from Gene to another very small, I'll let you develop it. For those of us who don't know or may have forgotten, you coined the word meme, a word that is shot like a laser into the heart of the modern lexicon. Since we have the words inventor before us, Would you share with us what a meme is and how does it relate to cultural evolution?
Well, I originally proposed it in the last chapter of The Selfish Gene, the first edition of The Selfish Gene, as an antidote to the message of the rest of the book, which is that the gene is the unit of natural selection. And the gene is the unit of natural selection because it is potentially immortal, it's very high fidelity, it's copied from generation to generation, therefore it really matters whether it survives or not. But I wanted to make the point that it didn't have to be DNA. I believe that Darwinism is a much more general phenomenon than just the one that we normally think of. For example, I believe that life on other planets, if there is life on other planets, and I'm betting there is, it will be Darwinian life. Whatever else, however alien it may be, it will be Darwinian life. It will evolve by some equivalent of Darwinian natural selection. So you could speculate about alternatives to DNA that would do the job of being the replicator on another planet. But then I said, maybe we don't need to go to another planet. Maybe there's another replicator, which could be the basis of a kind of evolution, staring us in the face on this very planet, the meme, the unit of cultural inheritance. If something is copied from brain to brain, whether it's a tune or a catchphrase or a clothes fashion or a style of any sort, or an accent, if it's copied from brain to brain, then it is a kind of replicator, and it might be the basis for a form of natural selection. If it is a tune, for example, you could go out into the street and whistle a tune, and if it's a catchy tune, that's what catchy means, somebody else might pick up the tune and whistle it and go in a different direction, and somebody else might pick it up and whistle it. And the tune might then spread as a kind of epidemic. Epidemics spread culturally in schools. They're called crazes. At school, a child may introduce a particular game, a skipping game, say, or something like that. And that it spreads through the whole school as a sort of epidemic. It even has a similar time course to a measles epidemic or a flu epidemic. It rises and then dies away. It may jump to another school if, say, the sibling of one of the children in this school takes it to that school and introduces the craze. I introduced a craze to in my boarding school at the age of about 9 for an origami for folding paper to make a Chinese junk. And it spread right through the school. Everybody in the school was making Chinese junk. So I, having taught people to do it, they taught others to do it. I had learned to make the Chinese junk from my father, who had learned it in a craze 25 years earlier at the very same school. So it jumped 25 years and then spread again. It has all the attributes of an epidemic. Well, I think that the meme, the unit of cultural inheritance, might be the basis for a kind of Darwinian selection. Because it's only good tunes, it's only catchy tunes that spread, it's only interesting sorts of origami that would be, or interesting crazes that would spread through a school. And clothes fashions, the infamous reverse baseball cap, which I believe actually lowers the IQ. It's something to do with the band that crushes the skull. Clearly there's a worldwide epidemic. I'm so naive that when I first started seeing baseball caps in Britain, I said to myself, oh, a lot of people seem to have been to America. the point is I was not actually trying to make a contribution to the study of the theory of human culture. I was really actually just trying to downplay the gene as the only unit of natural selection. I was trying to make the point that anything that is self-replicating with high fidelity is potentially a unit of natural selection.
Fascinating. So the very concept of meme is itself sort of a meme.
It is, yeah.
So I think all of us like to have famous people talk about us. In that spirit, what is your current perspective on America, and how has it changed over time?
Well, I've been coming to America for a number of years. I don't know what to say. I mean, I think America's two countries. I mean, I find that there's... I mentioned earlier the 43% who think the world is less than 10,000 years old. Where are these people? I never meet them. And yet the polls seem to suggest that they're there. So I just sort of feel that we're dividing into... This country is dividing into two. I'm not sure that I've noticed any very great changes, no more than in the rest of the world. I mean, there are clearly changes in clothes fashions and car fashions and things like that. That infamous statistic of over 40% believing in young Earth creationism, that's been steady ever since the 1980s. That's not changing. There are more encouraging statistics about religion. Religious belief is declining in America. The number of people in America who subscribe to no religion, describe themselves as none of the above, is now more than 20%, which compares favorably with any one religion. So it is a very large constituency, and I think it's about time that American politicians started waking up to the fact that this constituency is very large. And along with sucking up to for the Irish vote and the Polish vote and the Jewish vote and the Catholic vote and all these other things that they suck up to, they might give a certain passing look at the non-believers' vote, because it is a very substantial one, but it hasn't organized itself into a lobby. And that is one of the things, actually, that the American branch of the Richard Dawkins Foundation is trying to do, the openly secular campaign, which is trying to raise consciousness among people generally, that non-believers are actually very common, they're ordinary, they're you and me, they're the people you meet, they're celebrities. And I think bringing this to the attention of politicians would be a very valuable service. I mean, when you think that there are 535 members of the US Congress and not a single one of them admits to not being religious, that means that all 535 members of them are either religious or liars. I don't blame them for being liars, because they think they need to be liars about what they believe in order to get elected. And I think it's up to the American people to show them that they don't need to be liars. There actually is a constituency, a substantial constituency, which has a vote.
I wonder what percentage of them are both religious and liars. It has been said that it is better to light a single candle than to scream yourself hoarse at the darkness, something like that. What is your advice in these seemingly increasingly shrill and irrational times for those of us who wish to preserve our voices and our sanity? What can we do to advance reason in our times?
Join the Richard Dawkins Foundation. talk to people. Write letters to the newspaper. Come out. Don't be reticent. Be polite. Be genial. Be friendly. But be in no doubt about what you believe, and tell people what you believe. Don't be shy. Push towards a tipping point, which I think is actually not very far away.
So I'm going to venture a guess that you typically have more interesting dinner companions than most of us here.
I'm sure not.
No. Since you get to socialize with many of the best and brightest, I wonder if you could identify a few people that you think are setting the tone for the future.
Setting the tone for the future?
I wasn't sure how to phrase that either.
No, I'm not sure about that. The book is full of little anecdotes about interesting people, I suppose, and I wouldn't put them in if they weren't interesting, so they have to be interesting. I'm not sure that I can think of any particular names that I would wish to drop, because it might be insulting to those that I don't, I suppose.
All right, fair enough. This did lead me to a passage I was hoping you would share with us.
All right, yes.
Miriam Rothschild.
Miriam Rothschild, she's a distinguished entomologist. She's died now, she's very old. And she's a member of the Rothschild family and a delightfully eccentric old lady. I didn't know Miriam well, but so remarkable a character demands a digression. She used to invite Lala and me to her annual dragonfly party, so-called because guests were encouraged to view the dragonfly conservation measures around her lake at her country house at Ashton near Arundel, where I had earlier been at boarding school. Her garden was something to behold. There is a coffee table book, The New English Woman's Garden, in which each double page spread is devoted to the garden of some high-born or well-connected lady. The pages glow with immaculate lawns, shaded by immemorial cedars, tastefully understated flower beds, herbaceous borders, shady arbors, and ancient brooding yew alleys. All is as expected until you turn the page to the garden of the Honorable Miriam Rothschild. Her garden was stylishly her own. The plants were all such as the other ladies would have called weeds. They consisted entirely of wild English meadow flowers and unmown grasses. Waves of flower-decked long grass buffeted the walls of the house and crashed through the windows into the interior window boxes, which therefore looked like an indoor continuation of the garden. The large house itself was so smothered in creepers, you almost needed a machete to find it, like a fairy tale castle in an enchanted forest. Under faded family photographs, including one of the bowler-hatted and full-bearded second Lord Rothschild driving through London in his coach pulled by four zebras, were the cases containing the celebrated Rothschild insect collections. The luncheons themselves were sumptuous buffets. At one of these annual dragonfly bashes, she beckoned me over to her table. "Come and sit by me, dear boy, but first go and carve me a slice of venison. A very small slice, mind you, I'm a strict vegetarian." To be fair, the deer had not been killed for food, but had died of an accident, so you could say that her vegetarian principles were being upheld in the spirit, if not the flesh. Miriam owned a herd of rare Pere David's deer, brought back from China by her father, with a view to conserving the species. They are extinct in the wild. One of these deer had unfortunately got itself entangled in a fence and died, hence the venison on the ethical buffet table. Miriam was once invited to give the prestigious annual Herbert Spencer Lecture in Oxford. The Vice-Chancellor and dignitaries were all seated in the front row of Christopher Wren's magnificent Sheldonian Theatre. They had probably processed in, begowned, mortarboarded up, and heralded by the beadle with his mace, although I don't strictly remember that detail and may have embellished it. Miriam's lecture itself I remember well. It turned out to be a heartfelt plea for animal rights and a passionate denunciation of meat-eating. I was seated immediately behind the Vice-Chancellor and noticed him begin to shift visibly in his seat with anxiety as the lecture progressed. Then I saw a note being passed discreetly along the row, and an aide hustled out, doubtless running hot foot to the college kitchen, where they were preparing the post-lecture dinner that the Vice-Chancellor was to host in Miriam's honour. You'd think she might have given his office a warning in advance, but I suspect her sense of mischief took over. On another occasion, Lala had been trying to raise money for Denville Hall, the wonderfully hospitable and sympathetic care home for retired actors, of which she chairs the trustees. At that time, her favoured art form was painting silk with beautiful animal designs. My tie is a representative of that art form. Butterflies, pigeons, chickens, whales, fish, shells, ducks, armadillos, and offered them for sale in aid of her favourite charity. Knowing that Miriam habitually wore a headscarf, I encouraged Lala to paint one for this wealthy and philanthropic old lady in the hope of securing a large donation. The obvious, if unconventional, subject, given Miriam's unmatched expertise in those acrobatic little suckers, was fleas. Hugely magnified images of fleas, 9 different species. Lala painted the scarf beautifully, and I sent it off on her behalf, explaining the good cause. Finally, Miriam's reply came. Please thank your wife and tell her I shall keep the handkerchief. This handkerchief was at least a meter square. But inform her that she has sadly underestimated the flea penis, which, as you doubtless know, is proportionately among the largest in the animal kingdom. Miriam's letter was accompanied by a generous check for Denville Hall and by the gift of her book on flea microanatomy, inscribed for Lala with a note, see page 112 for vagina of mole flea.
So could you tell us what the animal is on your tie? And I understand there's a story behind your ties. Could you share that with
us?
Well,
this is a clouded leopard. It's from Burma. We went for Christmas last year to Burma, and it's become a kind of tradition that Lala has painted a tie for me to commemorate the event. The previous year we went to Antarctica, and she painted chinstrap penguins. But this is the clouded leopard. I think that the story Tim may be referring to is the one where I rather weirdly was invited to lunch by the Queen, and along with about a dozen other people. We were rather a mixed lot. There was the Australian rugby captain. There was a leading ballerina. There was Britain's leading Muslim. There were 6 corgis. The Queen was charming, and I particularly admired her outspokenness. She didn't just indulge in ordinary pleasant chit-chat. She spoke her mind. And what she said was, she looked at my tie, which had warthogs painted on it. Lala had painted warthogs, which, as you know, they're very characterful animals, but they're not exactly beautiful in any ordinary sense. The Queen said, "Why do you wear such ugly animals on your tie?" I was a bit taken aback, but you have to do your best. And so I said, "Ma'am, if the animals are ugly, how much greater is the artistry to make them into such a beautiful tie?" I think it shut her up.
Thank you. Your book is full of wonderful anecdotes. I really quite enjoyed it. If you don't mind, I'm going to pull out the audience questions. Do you think atheists are more pessimistic than religious people?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I wouldn't make a generalization like that. I'm sure you find pessimists among all sorts of walks of thought. I think that we are optimistic in the sense that we know that this life is it. This is the brief candle will go out eventually. But it makes us all the more eager to see those aspects of life which are worth living and to rejoice in the time that we have in the sun and to make the most of it, to try to enjoy it ourselves, to try to make it better for other people. And I'm not sure if that's quite the same as optimism, but I think there's no general reason to expect atheists to be pessimistic, no. Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you. If there is an arc of species supremacy, the age of the dinosaurs is long behind us, for example, how much longer would you say that humankind has at the top of the food chain?
Well, the dinosaurs lasted for a very long time. Actually, they're still going. They're called birds now. Humans are just one species, still surviving species, whereas the dinosaurs were a whole major group of animals. The dinosaurs went extinct, finally rather abruptly, in 65 million BC, It reminds me, by the way, of a lovely story of a museum guide in London who, when asked how old a particular dinosaur was, he said, 70 million and 8 years. So the guest said, well, 8 years, that's rather precise, isn't it? How do you know about the eight? And he said, well, it was 70 million when I arrived, and I'd been here 8 years. Anyway, they went extinct. The dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago when a large object, a comet or a meteorite, hit the Earth with enormous speed and with great force, and released a catastrophe of terrific proportions, nuclear winter equivalent, that kind of thing. We might survive such a catastrophe, because we would have the technology to perhaps go underground and to survive for the necessary number of years after the disaster. I think there might be reason to think that although 99% of all species that have ever lived have gone extinct, our species might actually be an exception. We have the technology, we have the ability to preserve our food supply by taking seeds underground, that kind of thing. So I think we might be, I mean, we're exceptional in all sorts of ways. So we might just be the species that engineers its own survival in the face of what would normally be extinction.
Thank you. There's reason for optimism. I'm a big fan, says the writer of the question.
But?
Nope. I'm a big fan, says this writer, of what Elon Musk is doing with SpaceX.
Right, okay.
If given a chance, would you take a one-way trip to Mars to retire and die there? If yes, would you agree that the idea is romantic?
I, too, am a big fan of Elon Musk. I think he's arguably the world's most inventive engineer. I mean, both Tesla cars, which I'm the proud and joyful owner of one, and SpaceX, the rocket company. You have to listen to what he says, and he is really, really keen to take humanity to Mars. I admire such a visionary as he is. The one-way ticket, the thing about the one-way ticket is that it's easier to get to Mars than it is to come back. And so there will, I mean, eventually I suspect it will become possible to both go there and come back. But there will be a sort of intermediate period when it's possible to go but not come back. And quite a large number of people are quite prepared to volunteer to do that. I don't think I would. I mean, I think it would be an adventure. But I think it would pall after a bit, living in a greenhouse with a rather limited set of companions. So I do agree with the questioner that it would be a romantic thing to do. But I think it might, the romance might start to wear off after a bit. And I think I'll wait until you can get a return ticket.
Thank you. More romantics out there. In what ways is science poetic to you?
I think science is an enormously poetic, a great vehicle for poetic language. I agree with Carl Sagan about that. He waxed poetic in all his books and his television programs. I've actually written a whole book called Unweaving the Rainbow, which tries to extol the poetry of science. The title comes from Keats, who criticized Newton and, by extension, all of science, for explaining away the beauty of the rainbow, by explaining what a rainbow is and why you get that spectrum. Keats suspected that Newton was spoiling it for us all. And I think that's total nonsense. I love Keats. I mean, I think he's a wonderful poet. But in this particular case, he just got it totally wrong. And the more you understand about not only rainbows, but everything from a scientific point of view, the more beautiful, the more poetic it becomes. So I join my voice to that of Carl Sagan, Richard Feynman, Arthur C. Clarke, other scientists who have extolled the poetry of science.
What a perfect segue to page 307, the poem for Charles Simonyi.
Well, this is a comic poem, but it does mention John Keats and Newton. And I wrote it for Charles Simonyi, who's a leading citizen of Seattle, as many of you will know, and who endowed my professorship at Oxford. So I'm eternally grateful to Charles Simonyi. And I composed this little verse in honor of his 50th birthday. And it happened to be around the time when when Unweaving the Rainbow was published. And so I had Keats and Newton and rainbows and unweaving in the front of my mind. This is the poem that I dedicated to Charles Simonyi. Never mind about John Keats or Newton's scientific feats. Forget your William Butler Yeats, William Wordsworth, William Gates. Never mind about unweaving. Here's a man beyond believing. Here's a man so smart and swift he penetrates Mach 2 at 50. Charles has his own plane and is, as you may know, he actually went up to the space station in a Russian rocket as a space tourist. I think he was one of the first space tourists in the world. Here's a man so smart and swift he penetrates Mach 2 at 50. And that's not all he'll penetrate. Even Windows 98 is not beyond his understanding. Happy takeoff, happy landing. See his supersonic plane go, vanishing right through the rainbow.
On a somewhat less poetic level, we love your hate mail videos. Could you share with us some of your favorite absurd arguments people have sent you over the years?
Well, the hate mail is not really arguments, not in that sense of the word. It's things like, I hope you get painful cancer, and I hope you get run over by a church van. I didn't get that. But I've had a recent one which failed to get into either of the two readings that I've so far put up there, which I think is really rather sweet. It goes like this. I hope you lose your watch and are late for an important appointment.
Mr. Dawkins. Any advice or suggestions for parents raising young free thinkers in today's world?
Well, the operative word is free thinker. Teach children to think for themselves. Don't tell them what to think. Tell them how to think. That's what's wrong with religious indoctrination, is telling children what to think. They should be taught critical thinking. They should be taught to ask questions. They should be taught to be satisfied with nothing less than evidence. When she was 10, I wrote an open letter to my daughter called Good and Bad Reasons for Believing. And in language suitable for a 10-year-old, I tried to persuade her that she should all the time ask for evidence. If anyone tells you something, ask for evidence. So don't indoctrinate children to be an atheist. That's just playing their game. Instead, teach your child to think for herself. Teach your child to ask questions, to ask for evidence, to be critical. And that's the moral thing to do. Indoctrination would be an immoral thing to do in any particular belief.
One more. With the rise of the non-religious, unaffiliated, and agnostics, and atheists, are we getting closer to electing an atheist president or prime minister, I suppose?
Yes, I mean, it seems pretty likely that Mr. Obama is an atheist, don't you think? I mean, he's obviously a highly intelligent man, very well educated, yes, I mean, I'd have thought it's pretty likely. You can't tell, of course, because in the present climate, they have to pretend to be religious, and so you just wouldn't know. In Scandinavia, that's no longer the case. In Britain, it's no longer the case. The leaders of the opposition, I don't think we've yet had an atheist prime minister, but we've had an atheist leader of the opposition who very nearly became prime minister. We've had that, I think, a couple of times. So, yes, I mean, I think that there will be... there probably already has been an atheist president. I mean, Kennedy called himself Catholic, but then he had to. Clinton, probably an atheist. I suspect there have been... these men are the same kind of people that you would expect to find in a gathering like this, and so it would be actually I'm pretty surprised if they were religious. The question is when will we get one who actually admits he's atheist, and that will depend upon the electorate finally coming out of the closet in a big way, and that's what I've been trying to encourage people to do.
I wonder, I know that it was one more question time, but could we end with that lovely poem that you end your book with?
Oh, right. I began by saying that it was going to be a sort of flashback, a series of flashbacks from this dinner, my 70th birthday dinner in New College, Oxford. And at that dinner, I read a poem which was sort of on becoming 70. It contains a number of literary allusions to A.E. Housman, a Shropshire lad, to the Book of Psalms, to George and Ira Gershwin, to the game of cricket, to Shakespeare, G.K. Chesterton, Andrew Marvel, Dylan Thomas, and John Keats. Now of my 70, 70 won't come again. And take from 70 springs the lot, subtraction tells you what I've got. But only if you're so alarmist as to believe the ancient psalmist. For what is said in Holy Writ, I'm one who doesn't care a bit. Away with actuarial mystics, I'll throw my lot with hard statistics. The Bible may be old and quaint, necessarily so it ain't. I'll go along with George and Ira. Across the reaper's boughs I'll fire a warning shot. I'm not about to let life's umpire give me out, leg before or caught and bowled, at least until I'm really old, and reach that bourne, the one we learn, from which no travellers return. That decent inn, no Marriott, presaged by time's winged chariot. Still time to gentle that good night, time to set the world alight, time yet new rainbows to unweave, ere going on eternity leave.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked this program, you might leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. Richard Dawkins is the author of The Selfish Gene, The God Delusion, and a new memoir, Brief Candle in the Dark. He spoke at Town Hall Seattle on October 7th, 2015. His talk was presented by University Bookstore and the Dawkins Foundation. the University Bookstore's Tim Nelson joined Dawkins on stage in conversation. Tune in next week for another great talk. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. We'll be right back.